Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me today is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
It's good to have you here and to talk about church history again.
Yes, although unfortunately we're going to be talking an awful lot about Joseph Stalin.
Oh,
Yeah, that's right. But it's important to do because, you know, it's not a pleasant picture of what's going on in Eastern Europe. But again, we see the church prevailing through some terrible times and some wonderful churchmen coming out of Eastern Europe. You can name a couple, I'm sure. And they've lived through this cauldron. And so it's important for us to realize that. It's a playing out in many ways of the promises of Fatima.
Right.
And in real historical terms. And, of course, we're fortunate enough living in the first part of the 21st century to look back and realize that it does have a happy ending.
Right.
You know, 75 years of communism, but only 75.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of the blood of the martyrs, I guess, we look at the... A few, two in particular, we know that have come out of this.
Yeah.
Us down the path.
Yeah. You know, you wonder, I wouldn't be the one to answer this. George Weigel would be the one to answer this. But what would have been the career path, if you could say, the vocation of Karol Wojtyła if Poland had been liberated by the Americans and
right.
There had been no communism? You know, he's fire-tried gold. And
yes.
Without that fire, I don't know. You know, I don't know.
It's true.
You know, but well, let's take a look at the fire then.
Okay.
Okay. We were looking at post-war Eastern Europe, especially post-war Russia, and the devastation, incredible devastation that the Soviets had and everyone in Eastern Europe had experienced at the hands of Nazi Germany. And that the one man standing at the end of all of this, the fellow that had the opportunity to recreate the world, in a sense, is none other than that paradigm of paranoia, Joseph Stalin. And he's going to cynically use three of the giants of the Soviet Union to re-coordinate then Eastern life, and that's going to be the Red Army, the Communist Party, and the bureaucracy. One would think that the Red Army would be the most important of the three, but in fact, it's not. The Red Army tended to take orders, I can use this now in the past tense, thanks be to God,
yes.
But tended to take orders from the civilian side pretty well. And especially since the army was under the control of Marshal Zhukov, the great hero of World War II, and he is very loyal to the government itself. So the army is not going to be a problem with revolt. The same thing is also true in the party. The Communist Party, one would think that the Communist Party in the Soviet Union would be the single most powerful element. But in fact, Stalin had purged the party of its old line leadership. Lenin had been dead many years. Mm-hmm. Trotsky was murdered. Others had been a coward. And what is now controlling the Communist Party are going to be people who are clones of Joseph Stalin, or at least creations of Joseph Stalin. It's known as the New Stalinist Wing, and these are young, doctrinaire, very narrow-minded bureaucrats. One of the best known later on is going to be Nikita Khrushchev.
Mm.
Yeah. He also uses another element, another independent force in the Soviet Union, and that's Lavrenty Beria, who is in charge of the KGB. The Secret Service inside. And of course, Beria has a file on everybody. And so when Stalin wants to destroy somebody, he can destroy somebody. Yeah. Basically, his foreign policy is, his domestic policy is to rebuild the Soviet Union, especially east of the Ural Mountains. His foreign policy has two parts to it. The first is to secure Eastern Europe under Soviet control. And then secondly is to spread the communist revolution. And he's going to do this without using the Red Army. The Red Army is used to control what has already been conquered. But you're not going to find the Soviet Union invading outside of its sphere of influence. Well, there are a few exceptions to that. Iran was an exception, and they were halted in Iran. There was a question Greece also, but that also was halted. But by and large, they'll use wars of liberation in order to spread communism in other countries. And then inside of the system itself in Eastern Europe, he would be using, when he needs to, what's called United Front governments. And these would be governments in which the communists would be united with other socialists and other members. They insisted on a few cabinet posts, for sure. They wanted to have Ministry of the Interior, Ministry of Justice, and the Ministry of Communication. Those are the three that they were absolutely must have. And actually, if we remember what had happened inside of Nazi Germany, when Adolf Hitler formed a minority government in 1933, he had pretty much those same positions, and those gave him the opportunity to overthrow the governments. And then the other thing he would do is he would establish elections, so-called elections, quote-unquote. And if that couldn't be arranged, then coup d'etats, overthrows of government. In 1947, you have finally a crisis in Poland with the breakdown of the coalition between the Lublin Poles and the London Poles. Remember, the Lublin Poles are the majority. They've got 14 seats in the cabinet, and these are communists. The London Poles, I believe there are seven of them with cabinet seats, and not only are they in the minority, but also they don't receive the support from the West that they had expected. And so a crisis takes place in 1947, an election takes place, and interestingly enough, the winner of this election, it was a dark horse, no one had expected it, but a party called the Polish People's Party, which was a moderate party, actually won the election. And this came as quite a shock. And so the election was basically nullified, and the Red Army oversaw the election, and guess what? The communists won. The second time around, you ended up with 394 communists in the National Assembly and 28 in the Polish People's Party. The new government then was formed around the premier, Bolesław Bierut, and he is for all practical purposes, he's a toady of the Soviet Union. He will coordinate the Polish economy with the Russian economy so that the two of them are inseparable. He forces collectivism, which is fought hard by Polish farmers. In other words, what happens here is you have small family farms in Poland, and this has been traditional for centuries. Now, instead, people were not allowed to keep their own produce. Whatever they grew, they had to turn in to the collective. And then they would receive their seed and equipment and everything else from the collective. But you're basically working for the government now. Mm-hmm. And this was highly resisted. And when the farmers were unsuccessful, basically what happened, human nature steps in. I mean, why work? Farming is hard work.
Yeah.
And why work so hard when you don't get anything out of it?
Right.
And so they began working less hard.
Mm-hmm.
That means, of course, there's going to be less
food.
Produce.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, this is a classic example of how the communist system itself simply doesn't work. It works against human nature. Where there's relative prosperity, it happens in the north, in Danzig, with the rebuilding of, or Gdansk, with the rebuilding of the shipyards there. and there's some prosperity there. And then also in the south, in Silesia, where there's a lot of coal fields. And so there's some prosperity that's taking place in that. The same year that Beirut is elected premier, a rather unknown fellow by the name of Karol Wojtyła leaves Poland and is able to visit in to the west and spend some time in France, in Belgium, and in the Netherlands. In June of 1948, he receives his Ph.D. And while he's in the West, he comes to know a number of luminaries, theologians, people who are well known already. For instance, Marie-Dominique Chenut, the great Dominican theologian, and also another Dominican, Yves Congor, gets to know Jean Danielou, the Jesuit, who later on becomes a cardinal, and Henri de Lubac, also a Jesuit. So he's hobnobbing with some, and these are all going to be Paridi at the Second Vatican Council, you know, and he had no idea that he'd be seeing these guys again, and does his PhD work at the Angelicum in Rome, where he is directed in his dissertation by Father Reginald Girardot Lagrange. He's a Dominican, and the key about him is he's one of the aides of Pius XII in writing Humanae Generis. So, you know, he's coming in contact with some pretty important people. If you look over his dissertation, the thesis of later John Paul II's dissertation is that reason can reason God's existence, but reason says nothing about the attributes of the God that we find in Scripture, the God of Jesus Christ. And that faith is a personal encounter with God. And so this is the foundation. I'm going to say this again, because this man is going to go back to Soviet-dominated Poland, but it's going to be the grounding. This is his doctoral dissertation, and it's going to be the grounding of his whole theological and spiritual life, is that reason can reason God's existence. That is so Catholic.
Yes.
You know. And at the same time, recognizing that reason can tell us nothing about God as is revealed in Scripture. And that ultimately faith is a personal encounter with God. Yeah. What that means, of course, is that in the mystical union that we seek to enter into, that's not an emotional high. And it's not emanatism. Remember back with the modernists? Mm-hmm. As it's some kind of a satisfaction of the void. This is an actual relationship that we enter into. And we'll talk later on, of course, about his own career back in Poland and how he finds himself skirting all of the pitfalls of a communist atheist society. Here you have one of these great anomalies, as we do from time to time, of a communist government and a communist party, which is atheistic in its set, in one of the most Catholic countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not nominal Catholicism. This is real devotional Catholicism. Hungary is another example. There you have elections right after the Second World War. The elections are run won by a party called the Farmers Party. This is a rural party made up of farmers. They beat a coalition of communists and social democrats. But in order to form a majority, they had to hand over to the communists basically one cabinet post. And so the communists took the commissioner of police post.
Ugh.
In 1947, there were new elections, quote-unquote elections. The communists won. And then the movement on then toward crushing the Catholic Church in Hungary. And we'll talk, of course, a little bit about Cardinal Mincenti in a couple
right.
minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In Albania, Yugoslavia, We'd mentioned before that these areas were liberated by the Yugoslavs themselves under Marshal Tito, who is a communist, but he's an independent communist. And later on, it's going to be pretty obvious from the beginning, he's going to be an anti-Stalinist communist, so much so that he will tweak the tail of the Soviet Union by having a foreign policy. This is Yugoslavia, having a foreign policy that is, first of all, pro-China. When the Sino-Soviet rift took place, he's going to be pro-Chinese. And not only that, but he's also going to be accepting American aid.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll have good relations with the U.S. But he's got a lot of work to do. You know, you have to understand that, for instance, in Albania, in the entire country of Albania, there were only 3 miles of paved roads.
Oh, wow.
You know, it really is a backward area. And as we're well aware of, the Yugoslavia that disintegrated in the 1990s,
yes.
He pulls that country together, but it's held together artificially through the Communist Party and through the Yugoslav army. And in 1948, the crisis was big enough that Stalin actually kicked Yugoslavia out of the international communist information community. It's called the Cominform. And so Yugoslavia then built its own army, and as I mentioned, in 1953, actually accepted military aid from the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. Czechoslovakia, we talked a little bit about that before with the tragic death of Jan Masaryk. After the war was over, and Czechoslovakia was recreated as the same country that it had been after 1919, the Treaty of Versailles. And, of course, today that country no longer exists because it was an unnatural creation.
Mm-hmm.
The Czechs and the Slovaks were put together, and they weren't asked whether they wanted to be or not. But the leading force in that is Edvard Beneš, the pre-Second World War leader of Czechoslovakia. He is still angry at the West, and rightly so, for having sold him out at the Munich conference and given away Czechoslovakia to the Nazis. And so he's still angry at the West. He still fears Germany, even if Germany is now in two parts, West Germany and East Germany. And so right at the end of the war, he helps to coordinate a purge of all the Sudeten Germans out of the Sudetenland. And many of them came here to the United States. Others went to Germany, Austria, but a good number of them moved to the United States. In 1946, there was an election. 38% went for the communists. The communists got, again, a coalition government, United Front government, and the communists got a couple positions. The premier he was the president, Beneš, but the premier, the day-to-day running of the government, was a communist, a man by the name of Gottwald. The interior ministry, communications ministry, both of those went to the communists too. Yeah. And Jan Masaryk should have been the foreign minister, but of course, as we pointed out, had been killed in that terrible incident.
Jumping out the window.
Yes, supposedly jumping out the a closed window.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In 1948, the United States offered Czechoslovakia Marshall Plan aid, which they were offering other countries also. Edvard Beneš said, yes, thank you very much, we'll sign up. Moscow said, no, you won't. And later in 1948, another election had taken place. A pro-Western government won out, but there was great uproar. Gottwald, the communist, was against Beneš, the president. Ultimately, what I guess you could call it a coup d'état took place, in which Gottwald, the premier, simply ousted Beneš, the president, and formed his own government. And of course, it's at that moment that that Masaryk then is killed. nothing will happen in Eastern Europe that's going to change the course of these terrible events until 1953. And that's when Joseph Stalin had, I believe he had a stroke, which resulted in his death.
What year was that?
This was 1953.
53.
It's a really a strange set of events. I mean, he's there in his apartment in the Kremlin. Only the inner circle is there. I've read accounts of his death, and it's really very bizarre sort of a thing. His last words were a curse on all present at this deathbed. Nice guy.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of a fitting way to go, you know.
Well, it's a right in line, I guess, anyway, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, certainly was.
With his life.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, he had nothing set up for a line of succession. There was nothing. I mean, and so in 1953, they're looking around going like, what do we do now?
What do we do now?
You know, I mean, there's no, the Soviet Constitution is simply not set up for a line of succession. And so basically it comes down to six strong men. And of the six, who's going to take over? And you could go right down the line and they disqualify each other very rapidly. The foreign minister, Molotov, was a real toady of Joseph Stalin. And everyone, if anybody knew anything in the Soviet Union, they wanted to make sure there wasn't going to be another Stalin. And so far, you know, the Soviet Union hasn't done real well as far as leadership.
Right.
Lenin, then Stalin.
Right.
And so Molotov is out right away. No one wants to have anything to do with him. Beria, the head of the KGB, he doesn't have a chance. Nobody, wants to have anything to do with him. And he dies a very strange death himself. Marshal Zhukov, the military, he's a military hero. He's got the army, but he has no support in the Communist Party, no support in the bureaucracy, and the Red Army is not used to having overthrowing its own government, and so he's not going to be of any possibility. Another is Georgi Malenkov, and he was a real possibility. He's an organizer. He's the second secretary of the Communist Party under Stalin. So now he's the most important person in the Communist Party, but he's not trusted by anybody. And another possibility, who had already died by this time, there was a man by the name of Zhdanov, and he wasn't going to be, he was dead. His replacement was a real long shot, and nobody thought too much of him. His name is Nikita Khrushchev. And he was the Minister of Agriculture, which is about the worst thing you could be in Russia. I mean, this is after the, you know, even as you're
decimated.
Going.
Decimated.
Yeah, it's absolutely decimated. To give you some idea of this, in the United States, about in the mid-1950s, in the United States, there were 7 million farmers in America feeding a population of 170 million people. Now, today, we even go beyond that. I think something like 20% of the world's population is fed by American farmers. Just absolutely, mm-hmm. We're a breadbasket. Absolutely incredible. But there you have 7 million feeding 170 million. In Russia, there were 100 million farmers feeding 200 million people.
Oh, my gosh.
So, in other words, they were so inefficient that a typical farmer in Russia could feed themselves and one other person.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do that out of your backyard.
Well, I couldn't. Not enough tomatoes.
Well, yeah, you know, me either. But
yeah. Now with all the squirrels around. I should have a squirrel farm rather than a tomato farm. But no, but they, yeah, it's that bad. And so when he becomes the Minister of the Agriculture, you can well imagine that he's facing a real problem. But he's a man with an idea.
Uh-huh.
And his idea is to establish what becomes nicknamed or known as agro towns, setting up new modern towns in which the farmers would basically live in town and then go out and farm in their own communities. And in the towns, it would be, everything would be modern. You'd have a concert hall, you'd have an indoor swimming pool, a gymnasium, lecture hall, and everything would be new. They built two of them, and after that, they ran out of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, and luckily for him, nobody knew about the fact that they had run out of money. They didn't have enough. So these two towns were sort of like showcase mm-hmm. Towns. Anyhow, shortly after Stalin's death, Beria is killed in a gangland style. Basically, they had a meeting of the top leadership, and when he walked into the meeting, they pulled out pistols and just blew him away.
Oh, my gosh.
And no retirement plan.
Out.
You know, yeah. In 1955, Milenkov was voted out of his party post, so he was gone. And instead, Khrushchev, what you find between 1953 and 1955 begins building alliances within the Communist Party, within the army, within the bureaucracy, and he comes to power really through something that's known as the cooperative effort. So, in other words, he's going to share power with other people. You're not going to have, if his idea is this: if I'm going to lead this country, I will do it through cooperation with others. I'm not going to be another Stalin, which is very, very popular to him. This is also, these mid-1950s are known as the new soft line mm-hmm. instead of the new hard line.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an increase in consumer goods. Farmers are allowed to have their own private plots and keep what they grow and sell what they grow if they like to. And guess what? You know, they become very efficient in their own plots.
Uh-huh.
On the government property, they're still pretty sloppy, but in their own, they're doing pretty well. So there's an increase in food available in Russia during this Khrushchev's time. He allows more for travel, even begins to encourage tourism. Which is, you know, kind of strange in itself.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, I don't know a lot of people who went to the Soviet Union as tourists during the turn. I remember in the mid-1980s, I was in Germany, had an opportunity to visit Berlin, had an opportunity to visit East Berlin as a tourist, and I did. It was the scariest experience of my life, walking into a communist city like that, and I'm glad I did, because it was a real experience of what it is to live in 1984.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it was 1984 that I did it. But but it was just a terrifying experience. I can imagine living at it, you know, day and night. But there are a lot of wonderful things to see in Russia.
Uh-huh.
And although the tourism, of course, was very, very carefully monitored, as
yeah.
was the day that I spent in East Berlin, I mean, I was never out of somebody's eyesight. But well, that's still a move, you know. Censorship was relaxed a little bit, at least until Pasternak wrote his book that later became a film, Dr. Zhivago, which is highly critical of the Communist Revolution in one sense. And the space successes.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time when Sputnik was sent up. The first man into space was a Soviet cosmonaut, you know. So he's having a lot of successes. Also successes in foreign affairs. In the 1950s, the Soviet nuclear scientists perfect the hydrogen bomb. And so now they begin seeking parity with the United States. That gives him a lot of leeway
mm-hmm.
in foreign affairs. He who brings about an armistice with the Koreas, North and South Korea. There's a cessation of war. So the Korean War essentially comes to an end. And he's, at least in the Soviet Union, is touted as the man who did that. There are a number of friendly talks between himself and Dwight D. Eisenhower, the President of the United States, and Winston Churchill, who has now been returned as the Prime Minister of Great Britain. And so inside the Soviet Union, there's a real sense of, you know, coming of age that maybe we can pull this communist thing off, you know, and be a different kind of a way of doing this. But there's an awful lot happening in Eastern Europe that's pretty ugly. In 1953, there had been riots in East Berlin and in Prague. This is right around the time of Stalin's death. And those things were put down with tanks.
Mm-hmm.
By 1956, however, Khrushchev felt safe and secure enough to be able to make a masterly move and turn communism in another direction, hoping to be able to encourage Eastern Europe to come along with them rather than have to constantly occupy them. And this takes place in February of 1956 in the 20th Party Congress. And in this, Khrushchev gives a speech in which he lauded the wisdom of Lenin and deplored the inhumanity of Stalin. This will be the first time, by the way, that you actually have a break with the concept of Soviet infallibility.
Okay.
You know, it is an article of faith in Soviet philosophy that the Communist Party cannot err. And here he's recognizing that, in fact, they did by having Stalin and what he had led to. His approach as he approaches the 20th Party Congress is that we are on the verge of a new age. It's an age based upon peaceful coexistence with the West, a recognition that there are different paths to socialism in different countries, so that Czech communism could look different from Polish communism, from Hungarian communism, from Yugoslav communism, from Russian communism. And then thirdly, that communism will spread throughout the world through nonviolent means. Now, some of that's window dressing, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certainly a lot of communism going on, and it's very bloody stuff. But this is the approach. This is his master plan that he had. Not everybody's buying this. In June of 1956 in Poland, there were riots for food, for wages, particularly up in the north in Danzig, a lot of heavy work going on, and people were simply still living under this idea of from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. It's more like from each according to his ability, to each according to, well, how much we're going to give you in return, and freedoms. There, you know, the Poles chafed under a communist dictatorship. The Polish army was sent in to put down the revolts, and instead they joined the people.
Mm-hmm.
It's at that point that Khrushchev quietly got contact. Now, here's the new softliner, right? Mm-hmm. And he gets in contact with the Polish government and says, I understand you're having some problems with your people and with your army. If you need, I'll be happy to send the Red Army in, and we'll take care of it with tanks. Well, there's a big confab that takes place, and ultimately the Poles back off. The Communist Party is restored in power in Warsaw, but at the same time there is a recognition that Polish communism will have some differences from Russian communism, and in particularly in the area of the Catholic Church. And here you have the opportunities of some real wiggle room that the Archbishop of Krakow, Wojtyła, and others are going to be able to exploit in order to protect the church and its people throughout this period of communism. In Hungary, you have a more of a fist, more of an ironclad fist. In 1956, also, as they watched the events taking place in Poland, the Hungarians also rose up in rebellion, and the Stalinists were run out. They were replaced by a Hungarian by the name of Ibra Nagy as their premier. And this takes place in October of 1956. he then farms together a new government that's basically open to non-communists. And finally, going into the jails, finally Cardinal Mincenti is freed. And let's talk a little bit about him. This is a Catholic cardinal who is arrested by the communists, and he's made the primate of Hungary in 1945. Now remember, Hungary, 1944, had that terrible experience with the Nazis.
Yeah.
And all. In 1945, the Red Army has come in, liberates the country. When they're liberated, Bishop Mincenti is made the primate of Hungary. In 1 year later, 1946, he's made a cardinal. Mincenti takes a hard anti-communist line and tries to protect the Hungarian church and the Hungarian people by doing that. What happens instead is the communists take a hard line on him. And in the late 1940s, he's arrested, put into prison, and remains there until 1956. So he's in prison almost 7 years. And during that time, it's not just prison. He's tortured.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of brain games are used against him. Brainwashing is used against him. And ultimately, then, in 1956, when the students rise up in Budapest, he's freed from prison. He has a relatively short period of freedom when the communists come in and take over again. And this time he is then brought to the United States legation. And there he's a prisoner within the U.S. compound. He would be arrested if he left. And this continues on all the way until 1971, when finally Pope Paul VI negotiated a release of Cardinal Mincenti. And he was able to move then to Rome, where he spent, I believe, the rest of his life. It's just a really incredible witness against communism.
Right.
You know, just really something. And it's in October of 1956 that, again, the hard line comes down on the people.
Mm-hmm.
Some 15 armored divisions were on the Hungarian border. These are Warsaw Pact troops on the Hungarian border. Imre Nagy sends a telegram to Moscow saying, what are these troops for? What's going on? And response back from Khrushchev was, well, it's Warsaw Pact maneuvers. And Nagy responds back and says, well, you didn't tell us that we were having maneuvers, but don't come into Hungary because we're leaving the Warsaw Pact and we're going to apply to NATO.
Mm.
Well, that went over like a lead balloon.
Mm-hmm.
And as I, you know, of course, the communists rolled right in. There was absolutely no reaction in the West. The United States, which had encouraged the people of Eastern Europe to rise up against communism, did absolutely nothing. 1956 is a presidential election year. The invasion of Hungary took place on October 31st, a little Halloween gift, trick-or-treat there. The national election took place just a couple days later.
Right.
So there was no reaction on the part of the United States. Britain and France did absolutely nothing. They were in the process of invading Egypt, which was a terrible disaster in itself, and so there was nothing there. In the United Nations, there was a vote in the Security Council condemning the invasion of Hungary,
uh-huh.
And it was vetoed by the Soviet Union.
Of course.
Of course.
A vote, and that's about as far as it got.
That's as far as it got,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. In 1957, with all kinds of egg on their face, the Soviets now had lost confidence in Khrushchev. And it looked as though they were going to turn him out. There was even a vote against him in the Politburo, and he succeeded in surviving it. The plotters themselves ended up losing.
Mm-hmm.
They got other posts. For instance, Molotov became the ambassador to Outer Mongolia. Nice guy.
Yeah.
Malenkov was sent off to Siberia to become the supervisor of a hydroelectric plant. The man who saved the day for Khrushchev was Marshal Zhukov. He had used military planes to bring other members, supporters of Khrushchev, back to Moscow for the vote, and he got rewarded by forced retirement.
Maybe that was better.
For him, it probably was. Uh-huh. Yeah. When you look at relations with the with other communist countries, things turned sour with the Chinese. The Chinese were under the leadership, of course, of Mao Zedong, who was a very hardline fellow, and he's very doctrinaire. And so he resents the fact that Khrushchev is in doctrine softline and in action hardline.
Right.
You know, and that's the reality. I mean, what happened in Hungary and all is in Poland is clear that Khrushchev was not some big teddy bear.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But as far as doctrine goes, he was not as doctrinaire as Stalin or Lenin or Marx had been. And so there's a shift and a break away from the two. Even more so after 1964, when the People's Republic of China tested its first nuclear bomb. And so now enters into the nuclear age also. Instead, Khrushchev tries to warm up to the West and tries to enter into a détente with the United States and with NATO, sort of a standing down kind of a thing. Even went so far as visiting the United States. I was about to jump in and say, well, he's the first Russian premier to do that. Well, duh, you know, Lenin and Stalin are the only other two, and obviously they wouldn't come. I think there was an interest on the part of Khrushchev to visit Disneyland, and Walt Disney said, ain't no way. But while he was in the United States, he signed an agreement with Eisenhower of what was called the Camp David formula, and that was that instead of rivaling each other with nuclear weapons and wars, that the United States and Soviet Union would enter into peaceful negotiations and through peace conferences, big issues would be solved. And that was the happy moment until an American spy plane was shot down over the Soviet Union. This is the U-2 incident with Gary Powers. It was an absolute embarrassment to the United States. We claimed that it was a weather plane, and it wasn't. It was a spy plane. We were spying on them. Interestingly enough, 20 years later, both the United States and Soviet Union would recognize what's called national technical means. We had a right to spy on each other, but not in the 1950s. And so this really ruined relations. The Berlin Wall really ruined relations. We'll talk a little bit later on why the communists had to build that wall. And then, of course, then the Bay of Pigs invasion is going to be another. And then, of course, following after that would be in November of 1962, Khrushchev's very artless gamble of placing intermediate-range ballistic missiles in Cuba itself and bringing about, as a result, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the one moment where we would come closest to a nuclear disaster.
Right.
If either side had made a mistake in that negotiation that went on between Kennedy and Khrushchev, we would all be looking a little bit different today.
Mm-hmm.
Probably having three eyes, most mm-hmm. of us. You know. Well, as a result, and we'll talk a little bit later on, I'm just kind of giving an overview right now. We'll talk later on about the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Berlin Wall, and things of that. And then I think really also looking at that in terms of Pacem in Terris,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, one of these great encyclicals that's just telling us something, teaching us something, and of course nobody's reading
listening.
It or
mm-hmm.
not listening.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like Rerum Novarum all
right.
over again, you know. Well, everybody got scared from this Cuban Missile Crisis, and so there was a real backing off. And so some good things came of it. For one, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which was signed by the United States and the Soviet Union and a number of other nuclear countries. I think Great Britain signed it. I don't think the Chinese signed it. I know the French didn't sign it. Then also there's the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, which basically said that the United States, Soviet Union, Great Britain, and others would not share nuclear bomb technology. We were sharing nuclear technology with the rest of the world, but to keep bombs from being proliferated out to other countries, we would hold off on that. That had limited success. In the end, the same peaceful technology, there was a movement on, the United States had a program called Atoms for Peace, which was going to build nuclear reactors for peaceful purposes, and that unfortunately morphed in a couple countries into nuclear weaponry. India, early on, used its peaceful technology to develop a nuclear bomb. Pakistan responded in kind. And ultimately, as we found out just in the last year or so, that IQ Khan, the top nuclear scientist in Pakistan, had been selling material to others like Libya, and there had been a cabal between a number of other countries and who knows, maybe terrorist organizations, right, toward this nuclear material. The non-proliferation agreement was an attempt to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the hotline was set up at that time also so that that the U.S. president and the Soviet premier would always be in contact with each other in case of some kind of a disaster. The movie Failsafe, that was such a thriller and a scary thriller in the I guess it came out in the early 1960s, kind of spoke about that. What happens if an air wing of the United States Air Force gets out of communication with the United States and then goes toward destroying a nuclear city, a Soviet city, and all of that, dealing with that whole question? In October of 1964, the inner Kremlin circle had had enough with the new soft line with Khrushchev, and he was quickly retired out by two other men who promised to cooperate, and that was Leonid Brezhnev and Alexei Kosygin. In the next three and a half years or so, it's relatively quiet. The new cooperative effort, that's really a new cooperative effort, seems to be happening. Ultimately, Kosygin is going to take a back step, and Brezhnev is going to become the man that he is. But in 1968, Czechoslovakia again attempted to free itself. And again, there's going to be a strong reaction against that. In Czechoslovakia, there is a demand for liberalization in the Communist Party. In Czechoslovakia, there's relative prosperity. There are some industries that are taking off. Bohemia is got a lot of natural resources and is well situated, well located, and they're looking at some other areas that are also prospering. East Germany is not prospering in comparison to West Germany, but to the rest of Eastern Europe is. And this is particularly true, especially in Czechoslovakia. Prosperity is coming about through the international trade of arms. Czech weapons are some of the best. And so in Egypt and also in North Vietnam, a lot of the weapons that are in those armies are being supplied by the Czechs, and so there's a lot of money coming in. Now, the Soviet Union is expecting that a certain amount of that would be sent to the Soviet Union as subsidies. The Czechs kind of don't care for this very much.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of the prosperity that's happening, in the middle of this is the 1960s, and that Berlin Wall can only keep out so much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a certain amount of ethnic difficulties. Remember that the Czechs and the Slovaks have been forced into each other. The Slovaks now, for the first time in their brief history, have a national hero themselves, someone they look up to, a man by the name of Alexander Dubček. And so in October of 1967, the Politburo in Prague actually elected him, a Slovak, as the first party secretary. And he ousts the president of Czechoslovakia, an Antonín Novotný, who was very pro-Stalinist and very communist, when he ousts him. And so Dubček really then establishes a free government. It's communist, but it's a free communist government. He censors the press. So Czechoslovakia all of a sudden has freedom of press. The farmers of Czechoslovakia are invited to decollectivize the farms. Slovaks are given greater autonomy within Czechoslovakia. The liberals all throughout Czechoslovakia are invited into the government as all of the hardline communists, including Novotný, are sent out. So there's a real internal revolution taking place. And Dubček, we have to remember that Alexander Dubček is a convinced communist. He believes in communism, but he believes that communism can only prosper in freedom.
Okay.
Which is not the Soviet model by any means. And he responds in 1968 by establishing what he calls the New Program of Czechoslovakia. This is going to be the Czech Spring, in which people are going to be able to use their ideas on how best to apply communism to Czechoslovakia. One of the things he does is he reopens the Jan Masaryk case. On May 1st, there is a huge May Day parade. And this is in May 1st, 1968.
Okay.
And the idea behind it is to show the Soviets, you have nothing to fear. We celebrate communism here. You know? Well, what Dubček lost control of it, actually the May Day parade turned into a huge anti-Soviet protest. On May 3rd, Brezhnev called Dubček to Moscow for a little meeting,
mm-hmm.
and basically laid the law down on him. And so Dubček then returned back to Prague and literally ignored everything that he had been told to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get the hardliners back in, get the police out, you know, stop these protests. There are all kinds of demonstrations all throughout the spring and early summer of, you know, June and July of 1968 against the communist in the Soviet Union. And so in July, he is again invited back to Moscow. His response is, "I'm sorry, I can't make it. I'm too busy." So on July 29th, the entire Soviet Politburo flew to Prague to meet with him. And on August 3rd, I mean, it was a heated meeting. And basically he said, you know, get out of my country. And on August 3rd, the elements of the Red Army that had been there as part of the Warsaw Pact left.
What?
They left. Czechoslovakia is free until August 20th.
Mm.
And on August 20th, Czechoslovakia was invaded by Soviet, Bulgarian, East German, and Polish armies. There was passive resistance on the part of the people, but it was impossible to resist this.
Mm.
People all throughout Poland went in and they tore down street signs. They tore down, I mean, not Poland, Czechoslovakia. They tore down all the street signs. They burned and destroyed all the maps that they could get hold of. And then they ignored the troops that came in. So, I mean, these troops came in and they couldn't find their way around how to maneuver and all. And they were just, the troops themselves were shocked at their reception. They had been told they were coming in to liberate the Czechs. And the reaction of the Czech people was anything but that. In the end, Dubček was was demoted to become the Czech ambassador to Turkey. A few reforms were allowed. Some of them stayed. The new president was pretty much a hardliner, returned Czechoslovakia back to the hardline. And the Brezhnev Doctrine was established, which is basically that the Soviet Union would do anything that had to be done within its own sphere of influence. So we've seen here now several attempts on the part of Eastern Europe to free themselves.
He's getting squashed.
They're going to need the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to need the right leader. It's going to have to be a guy wearing white shoes.
Yeah, that's right.
And we'll see how that takes place eventually.
All right.
Okay.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And very briefly, can we take a quick look at next week's show?
At next week, yes. We're going to be moving through some of this same material. I want to take a deeper look at Khrushchev.
Okay.
And particularly want to zero in on, even before Khrushchev, on the Berlin Wall. And then and take a look also at the nuclear confrontation between the United States and Soviet Union over Cuba. And I think that would be helpful for us to do at that point.
Sounds great.
Okay.
All right. Can we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.